It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's Get Out of That Rut. We are luring you into a world that's fragrant with spices, peopled with gracious folk, and where the food is just plain grand. Our guest is Maya Kaimal, and she's taking us to the land of her family, the little-known spice coast of southern India, a new travel destination for us. Jane and Michael Stern have stumbled upon a family feud in Hell's Kitchen. Food expert John Willoughby has the scoop on the great comeback of the sea scallop. And sculptor Kiko Denzer says if you can make mud pies, you can build your own wood-fired oven for next to nothing. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper with Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure, a practical guide to nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. Today, let's take a look at an orphan part of the chicken, the wings. Cooks don't give chicken wings much thought. A gifted Chinese cook once told me, though, that wings are the most interesting part of the chicken because they're neither white nor dark meat. They're a blend of the two, so you get the robust sense of dark meat with the quieter qualities of the breast. He opened my eyes to all the textures a cook can bring out in a chicken wing. The Chinese are obsessed with this kind of nuance, playing one texture against the other. I mean, for instance, they might stew wings, then deep fry them. Now, take a minute to think about a chicken wing. Depending on how you cook it, the skin can be almost as crisp as a potato chip or meltingly soft. You can end up with meat that's moist or nice and chewy. And, by the way, wings make great chicken soup. So let's talk about how to buy wings. Then let's look at a few easy ways of cooking them inspired by the Chinese kitchen. If you possibly can, always buy chicken that has been raised on organic feed without antibiotics or hormones. Free range is nice, but these things are really important. If you're hungry, figure 3/4 of a pound of wings per person. Rinse the wings under cold running water and pat them dry. Now for some cooking ideas. Remember, these aren't recipes, but basic approaches that you can vary according to what you've got on hand. My all-time favorite chicken wing is borrowed from Chinese roast duck. I call them mahogany glazed wings. Here's where a sweet tart marinade and slow roasting encourages the skin to crisp and most of the fat to drain off. Also, you get meat that's moist here and chewy there. They're great fun to eat. The long, slow cooking turns those wing tips into pure crunch. Sometimes you can eat them bones and all. Here's what you do. Use whole wings, marinate them overnight in a blend of vinegar, honey, garlic, fresh ginger, soy sauce, and hoisin sauce. Now, you'll find these last two at most supermarkets and certainly in Asian food stores. Put them on a rack in a shallow pan and bake at about 325 degrees for 2 hours, more or less. Baste with the marinade. When they're glazed and crisp, they're done. These are great hot or at room temperature, and I love them for picnics. Now, use this approach as a cooking guide, but change the seasonings. For instance, marinate in your favorite barbecue sauce or in a Mediterranean-style blend of olive oil, vinegar, garlic, and herbs. You could also take a dipping sauce from South America, that is vinegar, lots of black pepper, and garlic, and turn it into a marinade. Then there is the tandoori chicken wing. Season them overnight in yogurt and Indian spices. And remember, the key to crisp and low fat is long, slow cooking. Okay, let's move on to bringing out the meltingly tender side of the chicken wing by stewing them. For this, I've got to go back to Chinese cooking. The most masterful cooking on earth when it comes to turning unexpected foods into wonderful meals. This is an easy way to cook. You just put the wings in flavored liquid and cook until tender. Now, if you do it a day ahead, you can easily defat the stew, and the wings taste even better from mellowing in their sauce. So, cut up the wings. Then, in a 5 or 6 quart pot, take equal parts of soy sauce and dry sherry, about a cup of each, with some star anise or fennel seed, lots of garlic and fresh ginger, and a few tablespoons of brown sugar. Bring that to a simmer, drop in the wings, and enough water to barely cover them. Cook at a gentle simmer 45 minutes or until the wings are really tender. Then use an old trick to intensify flavors if the sauce seems weak. Scoop out the hot wings, and then boil down the liquid until it's lush tasting. Mix with the wings and serve over rice. So take home some chicken wings this week and join us again for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicles. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, offering the latest cooking tools and gadgets, from colanders and ladles to timers and garlic crushers. Target has the selection of cooking tools to fully outfit your kitchen. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions and is distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Well, today we are heading for new territory, at least new to most American travelers. Our guest is taking us to India, but not the India most tourists get to. She is Maya Kaimal, and she has written a cookbook about the home of her family. It's called Savoring the Spice Coast of India, Fresh Flavors from Kerala. This is southern India, where the air is scented with cinnamon and pepper. The food is unlike anywhere else, where hospitality is a way of life, and where a woman's role is very different from other parts of India. Our regular contributor, John Willoughby, is a food writer who takes little at face value. He's always checking out the story behind the food. Well, today he wants to talk about the big comeback of the sea scallop. I know a lot of us hadn't noticed that it was gone, but it has gotten pricey lately. Well, that's about to change, and John's got the reasons why. It's something about fishermen teaching scientists a few things. Okay, how many of you lust after a wood-fired oven? Raise your hands. I know I do, but sadly, I do not have the thousands of dollars you need to buy and install one. Enter a sculptor and environmentalist named Kiko Denzer. He's done a book, Build Your Own Earth Oven, a low-cost wood-fired mud oven. Kiko says if you can make mud pies, you can build your own bread oven for next to nothing. Stick around for this one. Then, as we do every week, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in the second half of the show. The number is 800-537-5252. But right now, Jane and Michael Stern are ready to kick things off. They write the road food column for Gourmet Magazine. Michael, you live in Connecticut, and I know you're always out there, you know, roaming the country roads, but do you ever get to the big city, you know, New York?
We often go to New York, and when we do go to New York, we hope to go up and down 9th Avenue a little bit, because as you probably know, Lynn, as I know you know, Lynn, 9th Avenue is a veritable festival of food from around the world. There isn't a country or a continent unrepresented along 9th Avenue. One of our favorite places, and I think one of the favorite places of literally generations of New Yorkers, because it's been there since 1893, is a place called Manzanaro's between 37th and 38th Street. Do you know it?
Do I know it? I think I was weaned there, for goodness sake. I think that's where I may have bought some of the first Italian ingredients I used in my first apartment in New York. And trust me, that's a long time ago.
Well, it's been there since 1893, and it's you know, if you have to do Italian Ingredients 101, that's the place to start.
Well, the great thing about it is that it's a combination kind of grocery store, eat-in restaurant, takeout business, and sandwich shop. It's a little bit of everything, very informal. There are a few tables there. A lot of the business is takeout. And one of the most interesting things about it, and this you may not remember, Lynn, because I think it's a relatively new development, is that Mangianaro's is right next door to a separate and completely unrelated, at least business-wise, place called Mangianaro's Hero Boy.
Oh, that, no, I don't know about that.
There is Mangianaro's on one side, Mangianaro's Hero Boy on the other side. Now, we had to find out about this. So we asked Linda Dell'Orto, who is the proprietor of Mangianaro's, what's the deal here? Why is Mangianaro's Hero Boy next door? She said, I don't want to talk about it. Well, all right, we did some investigation, and we discovered that, in fact, they're both owned by branches of the same family who have been feuding for the last several years about which branch of the family invented the six-foot hero sandwich.
And has there been any settlement of this?
There is no settlement. They do not speak to each other.
Are you kidding, Lynn?
Both places.
Blood feud.
This will never be settled. Both places make incredible-looking six-foot heroes. I think they make them even longer than 6 feet. We were sitting there, I remember, having lunch at the original Mangianaro's, and it literally took two people to carry one of their sandwiches out of the kitchen, one man at each end. It was on their shoulders.
Well, this is at Mangianaro's Grosseria.
Yes.
Where you dial 1-888-6-foot to order your 6-foot hero.
But now I think you ought to explain the art of the hero sandwich.
Well, let's explain the ingredients.
It is a big sandwich.
Yes. It's a gigantic sandwich. I mean, the fundamental ingredients, at least as explained to us by Linda Dell'Orto, it's ham, it's mortadella, it's two kinds of salami, it's capicola, it's prosciutto, it's Swiss cheese, it's provolone, it's peppers, it's lettuce, and enough vinaigrette to glisten around the edges of all the cold cuts when you put the top of the sandwich on. Of course, it's a great big long loaf up to 6 feet. That's maybe the maximum, but it doesn't have to be quite that long.
But now, which place has the better hero sandwich?
Well, I have to say that Jane and I have not ordered six-footers at both of them. We have had normal-sized heroes at both of them. And honestly, I hate
it's
to say
a tough
this,
call.
But I don't think I could tell the difference if the two of them were on a plate next to each other. They're both wonderful, classic Italian heroes on beautiful, fresh bread.
Certainly, Mangianaro's Grosseria, which is the older place, wins in the local color sense in that it's just such a wonderful old-fashioned, you know, sort of tin ceiling New York place.
Yeah, the new place, the Hero Boy restaurant, it looks kind of like a modern franchise fast food restaurant. It doesn't have a lot of charm, but I have to say the heroes they make there are pretty darn good.
Sounds, look, we'll do both, okay? And there's one other point here we have to make. True classic heroes never have mayonnaise on them.
Oh
mayonnaise.
Please.
Heaven forbid. But we're heading for 9th Avenue in New York City. Hey, guys, thanks.
You're welcome.
Have a good hero.
Guys, that is bad. Really bad. Well, Jane and Michael Stern are authors of Square Meals, America's favorite comfort food cookbook. Now, they come by every week, but you can take a look at their road food finds anytime. You just go to our website, that's splendidtable.org. John Willoughby drops by the Splendid Table regularly. Now, he's a food writer who goes beyond the recipe. He's always checking out some background information that might make us smarter diners or turn us on to things we might never try. John writes for the New York Times and a slew of national publications, and he does award-winning cookbooks with his pal, Chris Slazinger. Hey, John, good to have you back.
It's great to be back, Lynn.
So, John, where has the inquiring mind been?
Well, not too long ago, I was in Hawaii. And when I was there, I went to a restaurant and I was served these amazing sea scallops. They were so tender and creamy and delicious. And of course, I asked the waiter to ask the chef where they came from. And he came back and he said, they're from New Bedford, Massachusetts.
Which is not far from where you live, right?
Which is not far from where I live. So this seemed a little ironic to me. So I went down to New Bedford to figure this out. And what's happened is, you may know that off of New Bedford, off the coast of Massachusetts and Canada, is George's Bank, which is the largest fishing grounds in the world. This is where the boat went down in the perfect storm.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of George's Bank had been closed to scallop fishing because of overfishing. For the past 5 years, they had been unable to go in most of it, and this is the richest scallop area in the world. Then about 6 or 8 months ago, a bunch of fishermen, they were totally convinced that the scallop population was very great in the Georges Banks and that fishing should be allowed. But the federal regulators were very hard to convince of this. So what they did was they went to the University of Massachusetts, found some scientists, and devised a method of dropping a camera down to the ocean floor and simply photographing it so they could see how many scallops were there. And what they found amazed everybody except the fishermen. There had been reports that there was a high rate of scallop mortality in the beds, and that was true, but the reason was there were so many that they were suffocating each other.
Huh.
So when they got these pictures to the federal regulators, they decided to open these banks, and the harvest has been fantastic. So you may have noticed it out there. We certainly noticed it out here. The price of scallops has gone down, and the quality has gone up. And to me, this is just a great thing, because this is the fishermen and the academics getting together and working with the federal regulators to protect a seafood resource and at the same time give us the best of it. So now they're talking about this kind of crop rotation idea for all kinds of seafood, and I think it's just a great thing.
Now, are we talking about the big scallops or the small ones?
These are the big ones. The little ones are called bay scallops, and they are really rare. They only can be harvested in a small area between Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket and the coast of Massachusetts. They're very rare and expensive. I actually prefer the bigger ones, because one of the things I like to do with scallops is grill them or just sear them really hard in a saute pan. And either one of those, it works better with the big scallops than the small. So for me, this is a great resource that we can now use more easily.
Yeah, and the trick with the scallops, too, is don't overcook them, because then they turn to rubber.
Then they turn to rubber. And if you just sear them till they've got a nice dark brown sear on the outside, then they're like creamy and melting in the inside and crusty on the outside, and they have that great flavor. You can't beat them.
Do scallops mostly come to us frozen, or are they coming fresh?
It depends on the time of year, but they freeze very well. A lot of them, they do transport in ice so that they don't have to be frozen. They're just at that very low temperature. But if they are frozen, it doesn't really make that. It's like shrimp. You know, they freeze very well so they can be thawed, and they still taste wonderful.
Isn't there a designation, isn't there a term like dry scallops versus wet ones?
Yep, dry scallops are much better, particularly if you're going to sear them or grill them, because the wet ones have been treated with phosphates. What it does is it allows you to keep them longer without having to freeze them, about a week longer.
Mm-hmm.
But it also, they absorb some of the phosphates. It's not harmful to your health, but it makes them more watery. So when you try to sear them, they don't get as good a sear. The problem is it's very, very difficult to tell by looking or any other way other than searing them whether they're wet or dry scallops. So this is one of those times when it really helps to have a good relationship with your fishmonger and ask him or her, and assuming that they're honest with you, which most are, they can tell you. The dry ones are a little more expensive, but if you find them, they're absolutely worth it.
Well, and also since the prices have gone down, we can do this.
Hey, why not?
Hey, John, thanks.
Thank you, Lynn.
John Willoughby is co-author of How to Cook Meat and writes for the New York Times and other national publications. Coming up, an insider's report on a new travel destination, India's Spice Coast, and your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vakely Productions, and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com. Got an adventure for you. It's wanderlust time. It's time to think about getting out there in the world, away from Western culture, away from any frame of reference we were raised with. Here's what I've got in mind. How about India? Now, everyone I know who's been there says essentially the same thing. It's one of those places that you can visit again and again and still not fully understand. Now, most travelers end up visiting northern India, but we have some undiscovered territory for you. We first learned about it in the writings of Maya Kaimal. It's the Kerala region, and it's the home of her father's family. Her latest book is Savoring the Spice Coast of India, Fresh Flavors from Kerala. Maya, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn. Nice to be here.
Now, I need a geography lesson. Where is Kerala?
Kerala is, if you can picture India, as roughly a diamond shape. It's the very southern tip, and it runs along the west coast of the southern tip. So it's pretty far down. I mean, you're getting close to the equator down there. Very tropical and very lush and very beautiful.
Now, if I remember my history correctly, isn't this major spice country?
It is, actually. That's true. And the reason for that is it's the place where black pepper grows naturally and in abundance, and you get the most beautiful big black peppercorns from Kerala.
Tell me about the people. What are they like?
Oh, the people. You find a real mixture of religions there. The indigenous people, as I guess you could call them, are Hindu, mm-hmm. but because of the spice trade, which brought so many different waves of people into Kerala, Kerala adopted a really open-minded attitude towards outsiders. It invited them to really to settle. So you have Jews who came and settled on the shores. They came for the spice trade and became spice merchants. And you have Christians who came and settled from the Syrian area, mm-hmm. and they came as early as the 4th century. And you have Arabs who were trading, as we said, since the 10th century, and many of them settled. So with all of those different groups, you find a really interesting mix of religions and an unusually harmonious mix of religions. These groups really have coexisted very, very comfortably. And the other interesting thing about this region is you have a matriarchal tradition among the Hindu group called the Nayars, which are a really large section of the Hindu community. And they have, it's been phased out a bit, but you find for hundreds and hundreds of years, they have been passing the property through the female line. So women in Kerala have a fairly powerful place in society. And so households are very, you feel the female connection, the female bond very strongly, and you feel the tradition sort of passed on. Even today, you know, watching the way my family lives, everyone lives in my grandmother's house. And that's very unlike the rest of India. I mean, you hear about women marrying and then becoming a member of their husband's family and losing sort of all their privileges, mm-hmm. and all their rights, mm-hmm. and all their connections to their family. And it's quite the opposite in Kerala. The husband comes and lives with the wife's family. And so you have this wonderful sort of mother, daughter, granddaughter kind of line living together in the same house.
Interesting. What is the food like?
Oh, it's delicious. I just love it. It's my favorite food in the whole world, which is why I had to write two books about it, because I just wanted everyone to know what it's like. You simply can't find it in restaurants, and I think that's the saddest thing of all. But the food is, it's spicy, but it's very balanced with, there's lots of sour flavors, mm-hmm. and you have these lovely, thin, spicy curries, often made with a coconut milk base or a buttermilk base. And you'll eat those with different forms of rice made into pancakes that are called appam, or rice ground up and turned into lovely crepes you've probably heard of called dosas, or steamed into dumplings, or squeezed out into noodles. All these amazing forms. I mean, rice is a really central part of the diet, part because the climate is so perfect for it. Rice, coconut, and fish are really the central elements in Kerala's cuisine. And you have these thick stews, they're called, which is sort of a word adopted from the English. And that is a thick coconut milk and chicken, or coconut milk and beef, which is interestingly enough eaten by the Christians and the Muslims of Kerala.
And the rest of India doesn't eat beef, does it?
Doesn't eat beef at all. No, no. This is another thing that makes Kerala really interesting, is you find many meat curries, meat mixed with coconut and mustard seeds and curry leaves. Just flavors that are put together like you don't get anywhere else in India.
You mention in the book that curry leaf is used in almost everything. What does curry leaf taste like?
Yeah, I'd love to talk about curry leaf, because I think people don't know about it, and I mean, I can't imagine this food without it. Curry leaf is, first of all, it's a fresh leaf. You don't want to buy it dried or frozen because it loses all its flavor. But it's a fresh leaf that looks like sort of a sprig of small bay leaves, and I think it tastes like a mixture of sort of citrus and bell pepper. In order to sort of capture its flavor, you either drop it in hot oil so that the oil takes on the flavor of the leaves, and then you cook the rest of your ingredients in that wonderfully flavorful oil. Or you can, at the end of cooking a curry, you'll sprinkle, like cilantro, you'll sprinkle the leaves over the curry. It has a fleeting flavor, so you want to either add it at the end or drop it in that oil.
Maya, is this an easy place for those of us who have never been to India to travel?
It's such an easy place to travel. People will find that you can get by on English. The literacy rate in Kerala is actually over 90%. They have an amazing tradition of education there. So everybody can, or nearly everybody, can understand English. So it's definitely an easy place to travel. And it's also a place I would say people should travel by boat once they get there, because you'll see the countryside in a way that is really quite charming, quite beautiful. You take these little boats through the backwaters and see what life is like along the canals, and it's wonderful.
It sounds beautiful. Anything we should be aware of that any gaffes that we could make without realizing?
I think people should just know that in India, you should eat with your right hand and only your right hand. And the left hand never touches food in Indian society. So either you can ask for a fork if you're not comfortable with your hand, and they'll usually provide you with, or provide you with at least with a spoon. But if you can, you should try to use the fingers of your right hand to eat your meal, and people would be very pleased to see you making the effort.
Maya, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Maya Kamal is author of Savoring the Spice Coast of India, Fresh Flavors from Kerala. You can get her recipe for steamed mussels in coconut milk two ways. Either send a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's The Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or go to our trusty website, splendidtable.org.
Call me, tell me, and I'll be around.
open the telephone lines for your calls. Give us a call. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. We will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We've got Nancy on the line. Hey, Nancy, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Well, it's kind of a global problem at my house. I love to cook. I used to cook all the time, and I really enjoyed the creative urges to just get in there and be wild. And now I have six kids under the age of nine, and I find myself at a loss. Oh, you're laughing. It's funny sometimes, let me tell you. I don't know. I want them to enjoy different foods from around the world and different textures, but, you know, frankly, getting something that's not from a fast food bag on the table in front of them is becoming a chore, and I'm ashamed of myself. I should be able to do better with what I know, but I don't know. What can I feed my children, Lynn?
Nancy,
yes.
If you're feeding six kids yeah. every single day, woman, you're running a restaurant. I mean, this is like having camp every day of your life.
I used to think about having a restaurant, but now I don't want one.
Well, I wonder why. Nancy, first of all, no guilt.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm Italian. I'm sorry. It comes naturally.
Yes, I understand. I know. Okay, let's think this out. Ideally, let's think about what the criteria's got to be. Got to be stuff that you can make a lot of ahead and freeze it.
Well, okay, yeah.
Right?
That'd be good, yeah.
And or stuff that you can make real fast.
Yes.
How do beans fly?
There.
All right. Let me throw out a thought to you.
Okay.
You make up a big batch of dried beans. What does that mean? Okay. What that means is over the weekend, when you got a little time, now this isn't work. It's just that they're on the stove cooking. Okay.
Yeah.
You pour boiling water over a pound of really good tasting beans. Now they could be black beans. They could be pinto beans. They could, and ideally they're organic because if you can get organic stuff, I just think they have better flavor.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Cover them with 3 inches of boiling water. Let them sit for an hour. Drain them. Put them in a pot. Cover them with 3 more inches of cold water. Throw in as much garlic as you can just coarsely chop and get in there. Big handful of fresh sage, if you have it in the house.
Yes, indeed, we do.
Okay.
I'm Italian. I said we have to have sage.
Okay. chop up a big onion, chop up some carrot. Simmer those until they're tender. Now, you can make burritos.
Okay.
Yeah, with me? Are you with me here? Some flour tortilla, a little bit of tomato. Those beans already taste like dynamite. You stir that in. You can mix it with meat leftovers. Roll that up. In a flour tortilla, everybody's going to love it. Green salad on the side. You've got dinner.
Salad, yeah.
Okay.
That is good. Now, one more thing about, I didn't mention we have to raise chickens for organic eggs.
Oh.
And so, what do you know about egg things? I mean, we scramble so many eggs. You know, yes, egg things. I don't know much about cooking egg things, but we love our happy chickens, and we get about 2 dozen eggs a day.
Okay. All right. Here you go. By the way, the beans with the eggs are going to be wonderful because you can make a breakfast burrito.
Well,
scrambled eggs. Just scramble some eggs, throw them in with the beans and the flavorings, roll it up. All right, but here's the deal. You're Italian. How about a frittata?
Frittata, we do. That's about that. Frittata and scrambling, I'm afraid, is about all I do.
All right, but now there's other stuff you can do. You can take leftover bread, okay? Leftover bread. You with me on this? Soak it with whole grain bread, especially. Soak it with some cold water, a little salt, all right? Squeeze that out. Toss it with olive oil and garlic. Spread it in a pan, pour a can of tomatoes over that, sprinkle it with basil, and break eggs into it. So you get like little, they're beautiful because, you know, the whites are going to cook up and you get these nice bright yellow yolks.
They're orange, yeah. Okay.
Bake it in the oven.
Okay.
And it is out of this world. The other thing you can do with the eggs, a baked omelet. You know the famous strata omelets where you take the leftover bread?
Right? That looks so complicated.
No. Follow me on this one. You're going to love this. This is great because you can do it ahead. All right. Take a baking dish. Break chunks of coarse bread into it. Beat up your eggs with any kind of cheese you have in the refrigerator. If you have some salami, throw that in. Throw in your favorite herbs. Throw in a ton of garlic and throw in onions. All right. Just pour that over the bread. Stick it in the fridge overnight because you want the bread to absorb that all, and then bake it in a 350-degree oven for about an hour.
and you serve.
How many eggs do you put on this? I mean, you just
If you have
them up, or just leave them whole again.
Well, no. You just beat them up. If you have a 2.5-quart baking dish, I'd use 8 eggs.
Yeah.
And you can throw milk in there. You can throw ricotta in there. You can add scallions to it. I mean, you can do. You can make 18 different. I throw leftover broccoli in when I've got
it.
You know, okay. I throw in sauteed peppers if I've got them, or just, you know, roasted peppers. The idea is it's a strata. You can make it any way you want, and you could make a different one each week. It can be the mystery strata.
We have a lot of mystery food.
Yeah, well, exactly. But, you know, it's the kind of thing, you've got gorgeous eggs. Gosh, with those, you could do wonderful things. The other thing is try this idea of the baked casserole with that egg broken into it and baked in the oven. It looks so pretty.
Really neat.
It's neat. It's delicious. And you can do it with leftover tomato sauce. You can do it with bread. You can throw pasta. You know, it's a Sardinian idea. At least that's the first time I saw it.
Oh, okay. Well, that does sound good. Thanks for the tips, and I love your show. It gives me hope for the future when I will again be in the kitchen because I love it, not because I have to feed them again. I love my children, but they sure eat a lot.
We understand. Nancy, we understand.
Thank you, Lynn.
Hey, thanks for calling.
You're welcome. Bye.
Goodbye. Six children. Think about this. You're cooking for minimum 7-8 people 3 times a day. After this, she is going to probably open the most successful snack shop in her neighborhood, maybe in her town. Everybody, keep your eye out. Nancy's going to do big things. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's see who we've got on the line. We've got Michael calling. So, Michael, what's up?
This is Michael, Michael Stern. Hi, Lynn.
Michael! Hey, how are you? You miss me?
Lynn, I always miss you when we're not speaking. However, that's not why I'm calling.
So what's up?
I'm calling because when Jane and I spoke about a Hawaiian restaurant in San Diego, we made several horrible errors in pronouncing the name of the restaurant as well as the food they serve, and we got some letters from listeners who were a little annoyed with us.
I think this is putting it mildly.
Yeah. Well, there were a couple of major boo-boos, and I know you're going to be in Hawaii, so let me fill you in so you don't seem like the idiots that we were when we were talking about the restaurant whose name is Dakine, which is a very common Hawaiian term. It means the stuff, so you're going to hear it a lot. We accidentally or stupidly pronounced it. I can't even remember. I think we called it Dakine. Dakine.
Okay, so it's Dakine.
Dakine, it rhymes with spine. Dakine.
All right, okay. What were the other screw-ups so
one
I don't
other,
make
well,
them?
The only other one that I'm aware of, there were probably many, but the one that I'm aware of is we were talking about a soup that they make that is kind of dotted with bits of spam, a favorite food in Hawaii, and I can't remember how we mispronounced the name of the soup, but the correct pronunciation is Saimin, and it's a very popular soup over there.
Saimin. I remember this. You said it was a wonderful noodle soup.
It's a noodle soup, very brothy, and it's flavored with little bits of spam that are actually quite delicious in it. So it's Saimin.
Okay. Dakine, Saimin. And this is good, Michael, because I'm going over there to work with Hawaii Public Radio. Can you imagine me screwing up? Oy. Michael, you are a prince. Say hello to Jane for me. This
I will
is
do
neat.
That if you promise to put me in your suitcase and take me with you.
You're on.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
Goodbye, Michael. Well, it's time for our trivia question of the week. Now, this one's a cooking question. Here it is. What's the trick to cooking the very best polenta without stirring constantly? Now, if you've never made polenta, you should know that basically, to do it right, you're chained to the stove for 40 minutes to an hour. So the question is, what's the trick to cooking the very best polenta without being chained to the stove? We're going to be back in a moment with that answer, the secrets of building your own wood-fired oven, and more of your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions, and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We've got open lines for your calls this hour, so give us a ring. The number is 800-537-5252. But before getting back to the phones, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. It's a cooking question. It was, what's the trick to cooking the very best polenta without stirring constantly? Now, for those of you who have never cooked polenta, basically, you're chained to the stove for about an hour. Well, this is the trick. It's a double boiler. And no, you do not have to go out and buy a piece of equipment. You improvise one. Here's the deal. The very best polenta needs to cook for a long time, as I said. Any recipe, by the way, that says cook it for 10 or 20 minutes, it's not going to work. Just forget it. Italians who have had 2 centuries to practice making polenta know that you've got to cook the cornmeal a long time to get those starch granules to swell, turn tender, and release all that nice, mellow, warm corn flavor. So here's that technique that takes you away from the constant stirring. Get yourself a big stainless steel bowl, a 6-quart pot, and some aluminum foil. Put water in the pot so it's half full. Bring that to a simmer. Put your polenta, or cornmeal as we Americans call it, into the bowl. Figure 1/3 cup cornmeal for every generous portion. And for every 1/3 cup cornmeal, add 1 cup of boiling liquid. That's the formula. 1 part cornmeal, 3 parts boiling liquid. Whisk the liquid into the bowl so there are no lumps. Seal the bowl with foil, set it over simmering water, and let it cook for 90 minutes. Every so often, stir it with a spatula. Check that there's a lot of water left in the pot. You can salt the polenta to taste, and if it's too stiff, you can add boiling water at any time during the cooking to make it creamier. Now, you know it's done when there's no sandiness or crunchiness. And this is great. You can do the polenta ahead. You can keep it in that bowl covered with foil over hot water for like an hour. So making it ahead is not a big deal. Now you haven't spent an hour chained to the stove and you've got effortless polenta. You can get the recipe up on the website, effortlesspolentasplendidtable.org. Now we're going to get back to the phones. We're taking your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. And we've got Greg on the line. So, Greg, what pressing issue do you want to discuss?
Lynn, I really love using marzipan in pastries, and I'd like to know how I can make it.
Oh, gosh. You know, I'm with you. I never liked it until, I don't know, a couple of years ago. And then I really got hooked on it. It's you know, usually it's manufactured industrially because you got to grind the almonds so fine. But this is essentially the way, there's a lot of ways of doing it. A couple of ways I know of are you take equal weight, okay? No, wait a minute. Back up. Pretend I didn't say that.
Okay.
Let's say you take 2 pounds of sugar.
Okay.
All right. And you need about half a cup of water or a cup of water. You put that in a pot and you boil it until it gets to 240 degrees on a thermometer. You know, you need a special...
Is that the softball stage?
Oh, gosh, I don't remember. Softball, hardball, slideball, curve. I have no idea, but it's one of those stages.
Okay.
Yeah. And the idea is that then you pour that into a bowl and you add about 2 ounces of glucose, which is a dense sugar syrup. 2 ounces is about a half a cup.
Okay.
Whatever flavoring you want... Orange flour, water, vanilla, and then you stir in 1 pound of ground almonds. So if you have 2 pounds of sugar, you have 1 pound of ground almonds.
Okay.
That's one method, and you get this real stiff mixture, you know. Yeah. Another method is that you mix an equal weight of sugar and an equal weight of ground blanched almonds. You always need the skin off the almonds.
Okay.
And you mix that together with eggs, like 2 eggs. And you add, I would add corn syrup to that until you get a real paste. But you have to bake that in about a 300-degree oven for about 30 minutes because you want to cook the eggs. And then you can mold it and do whatever you want with it.
Okay.
Yeah. Now it's again, it's a matter of getting those almonds ground real, real fine.
Right.
What kind of things do you like to do with it?
Make Swedish tea rings and also macaroons.
You sound like you really get off on this stuff. Let me tell you, Craig. It's, you know where, you know, if you go to the Mediterranean also, you find it is just, it's used in the most interesting ways because almond trees grow there. There's actually, in southern Italy, I've had cookies made from almond paste mixed with orange flower water and just shaped, and just the paste is baked. Or you throw cocoa into it and you work it in, and then you just bake it.
Wow.
But that's how you could make it. The other thing I would always do, because I don't think our almonds have an awful lot of flavor, I'd throw a little almond extract into.
Oh, okay.
Okay?
That sounds great. I'll give it a try.
See how it works for you, okay? You got two different methods there.
Would there be any sources in books that could walk me through it, too?
Oh, absolutely.
What would you recommend?
Well, there's a big, thick book that has more versions of it than you may ever want to know, but it's a prose book. It's called The International Confectioner. And it's a great source,
okay.
A reliable one. I would say Le Notre's, I'm not sure if it's in there, but I could swear it would be, Le Notre's book on candy making. That's L-E-N-O-T-R-E.
Okay.
And I'm just, any book on candy may have it. And the other thing is books about Mediterranean food, because it figures into so many Mediterranean recipes.
Thanks for your help, Lynn.
Goodbye. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I am game to try just about anything today. We have Judy on the line. So, Judy, come on. Let's have a challenge. What do you want to talk about?
Well, from marzipan to mushy peas.
I like it. We're in the M's. Mushy. Oh, wait a minute. Okay, explain what you
I'll
mean.
I'll tell you.
Okay.
We were in London. And we were with some really nice people who wanted to take us to a restaurant because they had, he said, the best thing we've ever eaten, which is mushy peas. Well, you know. At any rate, we go to the restaurant, and they asked for mushy peas, and the waiter was so supercilious and said to this poor man, "We've never had mushy peas. I've never even heard of mushy peas." And the man said, "But I've had them here." Well, we're new ownership, and we've certainly never had mushy peas. Well, he was so crestfallen that I thought I should go home and make him mushy peas.
Now, these people are British that you were with.
Well, no, these were Americans, but they were taking us to the Ivy Restaurant in London.
Very Tony place,
and
as I recall.
It certainly is, but they no longer serve mushy peas. And from what I gather, it's a kind of a... like mashed peas, I would guess.
Oh, you have hit the tip of an iceberg, Judy.
Yeah.
Here's the deal. Now, I have to confess, I had mushy peas probably 40 years ago.
Well, that's sooner than I've had.
Well, they come from the north of England, evidently. Okay? And one of the things that I think they're eaten with things like fish and chips. So
probably.
A fancy schmancy restaurant like the Ivy, you know, your waiter probably was just incensed. It's like going into a very fancy restaurant in America and saying, "Can I have McDonald's French fries?"
Oh, no, but they actually did have it on the menu.
Oh, they did?
Yeah, but in years past, not now.
I see. Okay. Well, anyway, from what I understand, it's made from a dried pea.
Dried pea.
But I have a feeling, because when I remember tasting it, I thought it was just a tad sweet. And, you know, there's two kinds of dried peas. There's the dried split peas, but there's also whole dried sweet peas.
Whole dried.
Yeah, they're not super sweet, but they're sweeter than a split pea. But the idea is it's literally you cook the dried pea in just about enough water to cover it. You soak it overnight, and then you drain that. And then you cook it in just enough water to cover it with a little salt and pepper. And when it's really thick, it sort of makes its own puree.
Uh-huh.
You know?
The way the soup does.
Right. And it's thicker than the soup. You have to stir it because, you know, it can scorch easily.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea is it takes about an hour and a half to cook it, and then you stir in butter.
And that's it?
That's it. But it's like mashed potato consistency almost. And this is the part I've always wanted to know about what these actually were, because I've never laid eyes on one. But I understand the great tradition... Okay, in this part of England, is something called the marrow fat pea.
One word, marrow fat, like in bone marrow, marrow fat pea. Now, I don't think they're ever going to win any awards in terms of great sexy titles, but doesn't that make it sound like it's super rich in taste?
Yes. I was actually hoping you could tell me how to make it with fresh or frozen peas, but I guess that's not what it is.
Well, you know what I would try it with? I would try it with green split peas. That's what I would do because you can get them easily.
Okay, well, this is why
soak them
French
overnight.
Cooking has now overtaken English cooking in London.
Now, wait a minute, though. Now, think about how much you've loved split pea soup.
True.
Well, this is the split pea, the essence of split pea, the
Great.
Essence of pea.
I knew I couldn't stump you.
Oh, no, no, no. No, I have to tell you something. You know what you can stump me on? The ordinary stuff. The arcane stuff is where I go berserk. I have more totally useless information in the back of my brain. But, you know, don't ask me how to spell the word A-N-D. Goodbye, darling.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks, Judy. You know, if you make bread or you bake pizza, you're probably like me. I lust after my own wood-fired oven. Talk about connecting with our primal selves. Try cooking with fire and you are one with the forces of nature. But the flip side here is the cost. When you talk wood-fired ovens, you're talking thousands of dollars. But guess what? I came across a different take on this oven issue. It's a book called Build Your Own Earth Oven. It's by a man named Kiko Denzer, and we've asked him to join us. Kiko, welcome.
Hi, Lynn.
Okay, here's the big question. Can anybody do this?
Oh, yeah. If you can build, if you made mud pies when you were a kid, you can build an oven. And that's part of the beauty of it. The material itself is, you know, it takes you back to those primal origins you were talking about. And we're all builders. It's part of our genetic material. And kids know that, but adults tend to get it taught out of them. You know, you go to school and you think, well, I have to be an expert in something, so you forget everything else. But I think what I find is that, you know, you give people mud and they remember. So it has many different beauties, and that's one of them.
What does it look like? What does the bread oven look like when it's done?
The basic oven is sort of the classic beehive shape, so it's hemispherical, and it's just a beautiful rounded form growing out of the earth.
Now, what do you need to do this, though? You say if you can make a mud pie, you can make an oven, but, you know, earth is different from one part of the country to another. Do I have to make a brick? What's involved?
All right. Well, this is so simple, I had to write it down. So if you'll bear with me, I'll read it to you.
All right.
So, as I said, if you made mud pies when you were a kid, you can make an earthen oven. And it's something that people have been doing for millennia all over the world. Here in the U.S., legend has it that the pioneers on the Oregon Trail baked bread in ovens that they dug into the closest dirt bank. So, and this is the point. An oven is just a hole in the ground.
Huh.
So there are three steps, basically. First, you take a pile of damp sand and you pat it into a hemisphere. Then you cover that with a layer or three of mud, depending on your oven.
Uh-huh.
Then you cut out a doorway and you take out the sand. And there's your hole.
Oh!
Right? It's just that sand form is shaping the void, right? You fill up the void with sand. You
right.
Shape it the way you want it. And then when you've packed the mud around it, you cut a hole and you pull it out.
And that's it.
And that's it. Then your oven is ready for a fire, and if you speed dry it, you can bake it the next day. There are a few other details, and they're equally brief, but they're worth mentioning.
Mm-hmm.
For the floor of the oven, it's worth rounding up some bricks, and you can use standard red brick or fire brick. And if you can't find used one, you can buy new, and fire bricks, which are sort of the fanciest choice, might cost a bit more than a dollar each. So a typical oven would take 20 to 30 bricks. Then you set them on a bed of sand without mortar, and you build your sand form on top. So that takes care of the floor.
Uh-huh.
And then the mud for the oven, in most parts of the country, the soil layer below the topsoil will have clay in it. And clay is what makes mud sticky, and it's what holds the oven together. So if you have a yard, you probably have decent building soil. And if you don't have a yard, you can find somebody who's digging a hole and just ask for a wheelbarrow loader. And you can use it straight out of the ground, or you can mix it with sand.
And those are choices that, you know, every person can make for themselves depending on their soil. So however you go about it, you should keep in mind that earth is the world's most common and I think the best building material you can ask for. It's safe, it's cheap, it's easy, it's environmentally friendly, it's totally biodegradable, and it's beautiful.
Okay, Kiko, I've got my oven, I've built it. How do I cook in it?
You build a fire in it, and you let the fire burn. And the oven absorbs the heat of the fire. And when the fire has burned down, you scoop out the coals and sweep the floor, and then you're ready to cook.
So you slip a pan of chicken in there, or you put your bread in there?
Yep. And the bread you can cook directly on the floor, which in fact is one of the things that makes such good bread, is you get that extra oven spring off the hot oven floor.
Oh, yeah. But you can cook anything in the oven, right?
Oh, it makes beautiful roast meats. Roast vegetables are just outrageous. And pies and anything that you would cook in a regular oven, you can cook in this one. And in fact, the declining heat is nice for things like beans or steamed breads that take a long time and low heat.
Uh-huh.
Because you can pretty much just put them in and forget about them.
Yeah, because the heat lasts for a long, long time.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to be making mud pies. Kiko, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Guess what I'm doing this summer? Sculptor Kiko Denzer is author of Build Your Own Earth Oven, a low-cost wood-fired mud oven. He lives and works in Oregon in the light, airy studio he built himself out of mud. Well, that's all we've got time for today. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. And remember, you can call us at any time. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with a disturbing observation from Richard Folkart. To dream of lettuces is said to portend trouble. Don't ask. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, featuring Henkel's top-of-the-line, fully forged professional cutlery. Henkel's is the knife choice of many professional chefs. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's the Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That's splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lubke and Jennifer Russell. Musical inspiration this week from Rob Hebzinski. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.